Coming up next is the Professor James McCanny Science Hour at the Crossroads. Now on shortwave, WWCR, frequency 5.070 at 7 p.m. Eastern on Thursdays, and also on Reality Radio Network Internet at www.realityradionetwork.com on Thursday evenings at 9 p.m. Eastern. And now, once again, here's your host, the Professor.
April 17, 2008. Tremendous amount of material to cover tonight. And, of course, this week being a big financial week in most of your lives. But I'll mention a few things about that, of what I call fun facts about money or economics. And I'll do that just before the main science topic. By the way, the main science topic will be the chemistry of comet tails. A very interesting topic, and some people might say, well, gee, what does that have to do with me? Well, it might be that many of the chemicals that make up your body, the complex organic ones, were made in the tail of a comet, and a lot of other things. Now, I talked about these concepts in my very early papers, and of course, NASA, in true NASA to form style, picked that up and, of course, wanted to state that ice ball comets, their dirty snowball comet model or whatever you call it, was the harbinger of life on Earth. But the only problem with their model is that then those molecules had to be formed someplace else, out of sight, out of mind, and they never could quite tell you where they did form if they became part of their dirty snowball at some point. They certainly didn't form in the dirty snowball, so they must have formed someplace else. Well, where was that, NASA? Well, they never bothered to answer that question. As long as they can put something out of sight, out of mind, in the long ago, then they don't have to answer those questions. And, of course, since there's no peer review of NASA articles or work, then nobody gets to ask them that question. Isn't that cute? So the real situation, comets are not dirty snowballs. They do produce organic chemicals, complex ones, and this scientific actuality, the reality of chemical formation, is that when we observe comet tails in the infrared, the infrared signature only give us the basic, very, very most basic building block information of the complex chemicals. So there has never been a real complex analysis of the components of comet tails, but I guarantee you everything all the way up to viruses are growing in the tails of comets. So, and that I've talked about before also, this last fall when Venus came by, the inferior conjunction, and this is in the medical journals, this is not just me talking. Going all the way back to the 12th century, the Chinese have observed that the influenza, they call it the swine flu, would come in during the inferior conjunction of Venus. Interesting. So, then those viruses, of course, in the long cometary tail of Venus, which is still there, is very faint. We've actually observed it a couple times. And, of course, that I reported, that's back in the 90s when that was first observed by the SOHO satellite, and I reported that on my webpage way back then. So tonight's main science topic, the chemistry of comet tails. And that's a topic I could talk about for days and days and days at a university graduate student level class, and it could get very complicated, but what I'm going to try and do tonight is break it down so you understand basically the concepts of how chemicals form in the plasma discharge comet model. So they are actually forming in space in the comet tail in my model, and they are growing and developing during the lifetime of the comet, and then they get locked into that comet nucleus because they're being drawn into the comet nucleus in the plasma discharge comet model. That's my comet model. It's been in my work since I initiated this back in the 70s. And also, eventually some of the planets do pass through comet tails, as we have done in the past. We spent about 40 days and 40 nights in a comet tail a number of thousands of years ago. The comet tail, when Venus was a large comet coming through the solar system and ravaging Mars, of course, relieving Mars of its atmosphere and oceans. And when we went through the comet tail of Venus, we had a tremendous flood and influx of hydrocarbons, oil, naphtha, as they called it in the biblical days. But at any rate, so yes, this does affect your life drastically. In fact, much of what you are made of today probably was originally built in a comet tail. So before that, I have a number of comments here. And let's just talk about the Pope. The Pope visiting our good President George Bush. Gee, now, isn't that interesting? Because the Pope was supposedly kind of on the skids with George because of his war in Iraq and the war crimes, etc. But now, apparently, there's a little meeting, and I just want to remind you, remember when the Queen visited? Not my Queen. She ain't my Queen, and I don't believe in queens. In fact, most of the feedback I got from people in England don't consider they're her queen either. The queen is not well liked in England, as they would have you believe that she is well liked. Most people really don't like the queen and everything about the queen. But anyway, be that as it may, was it May? The queen visited and had this big royal meeting. And went to the Plymouth Rock, and they had a big ceremony. And I always thought, why is the Queen of England visiting Plymouth Rock? Because those people were coming here to get away from her and her kind. But anyway, the Pope is visiting now, and these regal meetings have quite a bit of significance, actually. And remember, the other person that the Queen visited when she was here was NASA. Now, why is the Queen of England visiting NASA? Well, Pope's got a similar agenda, and it turns out that, of course, NASA has been very busy building cave cities. So the Queen was busy seeing her new underground apartment complex, or as they call them, hotels. And, of course, the Pope is here, and he's, I'm sure, going to see his new accommodations. And all these people are getting very ready for something. And I said before, when the Queen leaves England, watch out. But right now we're dealing with the Pope visiting, making his initial moves, and just before May of 2008. This May 2008 is going to turn into a very special month, I have a feeling. We'll have to wait and see, but a lot of interesting things are leading up to this, not the least of which is control. Control of the public, getting the public under the thumb of everything that they can put their thumb on. So at any rate, more of that in the next few weeks. But the Pope getting an honorable mention on this show for visiting his supposed arch enemy, George Bush, who, of course, wants to start a war in Iran right now. So I'm just wondering why the Pope's visiting this guy. Doesn't seem they should have much in common. A couple weeks ago, I reported on the Associated Press study done on our drinking water. And it now turns out, a short time before I made the announcement on my show, the Associated Press study on drugs, pharmaceutical drugs, in the drinking water, deep water aquifers of the United States. Over 40 deep water aquifers, those are the main sources of water for the entire United States, were found to have pharmaceutical drugs at measurable levels. That means you could take a glass of water out of any of those deep aquifers and measure pharmaceutical drugs. Not just anyone, all of them. Everything, every drug that's ever been produced is in that water. So you can imagine that every illegal drug is in there too. So now it turns out that the Associated Press had given this information to Congress over 2 years ago, and it was just hitting the streets a couple weeks ago for public consumption. And supposedly there was a great interest in Congress, so they formed a task force. Well, whenever you want something not done, give it to Congress. They'll form a task force. They'll meet. They'll have some very nice meals off of this, and nothing will get done. That's pretty much the process, and that's what happened in this case. The task force had produced 70 pages of documents, including emails, weekly reports, and these were released under the Freedom of Information Act as the Senate subcommittee prepares to convene actually a couple days ago as of this show. So dealing with the pharmaceutical drugs in American drinking water. The panel, of course, was formed, as I said, 2 years ago based on the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy recommendation. Now, the task force coordinator said, get this, there has been considerable congressional interest in this topic, however, this is an interesting twist. The White House classified the task force agenda, minutes, and internal documents. So all of the information that came out of this task force was considered as internal documents of the White House and therefore could not be released. So of the 70 pages that were given out, now 70 pages would be about a quarter an inch of a stack of paper, the additional information they said was about 10 inches high, and that's what was not being released. The task force did not meet their deadline to release this information back to Congress, but I always love these kind of bureaucratic statements. The research strategy spokesperson said that the task force needs extra time to serve. Now, here's a quote. I always like this, the way they tangle these words. This is bureaucraties, as they say. Task force needs extra time to serve as an internal federal vehicle to further enhance interagency collaboration. And when I read that, I said, what? I got a big red what with the big question mark on my notes here. Let me read that again. To serve as an internal federal vehicle to further enhance interagency collaboration. That's after 2 years of the task force meeting. So they need further study with interdepartmental cooperation. Now, the task force included 9 federal agencies, including the Environmental Protection Agency, the Agriculture Department, and the Food and Drug Administration. So, the Associated Press now is trying to get this awareness of this in Congress, but I would say don't hold your breath. You'll turn blue before Congress does anything true. That's a little, sorry for the little rhyme there, but I just had to do that. NASA, it was discovered, had 40 cases of cancer amongst people that work on the same floor at the NASA Glenn Research Center. Now, NASA, of course, denies that there was any problem and that, of course, their primary mission is safety of their employees. But the union that represents the employees said that most employees did not fill out the survey questions correctly because they were fearful of reprisal for answering the survey honestly. So at any rate, it's being investigated by Congress. I wouldn't hold my breath on that one either, folks. But the reason I bring this up, a number of years ago, and I tried to look through my notes because I actually mentioned it on this show, there was, I believe, a university research facility and an entire third floor of people on that floor at the same time came down with cancer. So they cleared the floor, tried to study the situation, and of course nothing ever came of it. They never discovered the cause of cancer and said, my goodness, this was just coincidence. And I'm trying to remember where that was. So at any rate, I'm sure it'll come to me after the show. but it's in my notes, and when you do as many shows as I do, finding those specifics, those small little topics sometimes is difficult. But especially when, at any rate, I'll go on to the next topic. New releases. I've talked in the past few weeks that there are new releases coming out soon, and they are still edging their way towards the release date. Sometimes when I'm working on these, you have to dot all your I's and cross all your T's, so to speak, before the releases. And so some of this is still going on, and so I apologize for the releases not being available at this time. But there are actually four of them. They should come out in somewhat rapid succession, and the first one should be available very soon here. So just keep an eye on that. I apologize once again, but I am working on those to get those out as soon as possible. Food shortages worldwide. Isn't it interesting how all of this stuff happens at once? It's like an orchestra. All of a sudden, getting on the stage and all the musicians are there and they're all starting to play the music and the conductor comes in and raises his baton and all of the members of the orchestra start playing at the same time. Well, that's the way the world is being operated today. And so when you see food shortages, first in Haiti, then in India, then the whole laundry list, I talked about these last week on my show, every country seems to be headed for a food shortage. Well, the United States of America is soon to follow. I will guarantee you that. It'll be a very big shock for most people when they go to the grocery store and there's nothing there, or that the food has been tainted. There are, plant food shortages. There are products that have disease in them or viruses or bacteria, whatever the case may be. But they've been testing and probing with this in the United States just to get public reaction. Also to desensitize people. Remember the spinach bacteria scare with E. coli and spinach. And then there was various other things. But there will be some day when those are desensitizing. That's the way disinformation works. You let out a little bit, let the public get used to it, draw it back, then let it out again, and slowly desensitizing people to the fact that, food will not be on the shelf one day. So this is coming, so I would suggest that you become your own source of food. So that would probably mean for most people, you're not going to eat a lot of meat. You're probably not going to have a lot of dairy products, but start eating in a healthy manner, grains, sprouting, organic, non-hybrid. Remember those terms, non-hybrid. Those are the seeds that will reproduce, the heirloom seeds, and start growing your own garden. Have garden boxes that you could bring inside if things get rough outside, or if all of a sudden there's pollution events outside you would want to bring. And go small, small things like radishes, spinach, greens. Lettuce even can take a long time to grow. But start to learn your system. You will need fresh water. You will fresh filtered water. And don't plan on the city water being there for you. There, if you look in the city codes, municipal codes or whatever, they can shut those off on a moment's notice and actually prevent you from getting water by any other means in most municipalities. At any rate, I'm not going to go into the world food shortage much more on this, but start to plan your own daily life around being your own source of food, fresh water. And as people that I've talked to, these are people that have been through CIA training, through military training, and they always concur on one specific point. The people that are not prepared are the ones that will have to go out in search of food or water or supplies. They are the ones that are going to get in trouble when this all comes down. So just keep that in mind. You want to be your own source. You want to know how to work with your equipment and just have very rudimentary equipment. Good thing to have is a pressure cooker. It doesn't take much heat to cook food, grains, things like that. And by the way, remember, you don't want to cook rice in a pressure cooker, but other grains, etc., you can cook. It takes much less heat to do that, and you can also store food in a pressure cooker just by leaving the cover on. You may have to start it up again and get the steam going, because they can vapor lock if they if the steam in there condenses. Sometimes pressure cookers can have a vapor lock. So at any rate, it's just a good idea to learn how to use your equipment. The water filter, pressure cooker, a couple pans, and your sprouting trays, those type of things. Just learn how to live on those. Quick mention here of a political situation. Now, I haven't heard this anywhere in the political commentary or on blogs, so when that happens, then I mention it on this show. It seems that Bill Clinton, and this is my read, maybe I'm wrong, Bill Clinton and George Bush Sr., remember that they were running around, they were skipping through the White House office together, and they were raising money for Katrina, they raised money for the tsunami victims in Sumatra, they were raising money for Christian Children's Fund, they were doing all this promotion, and they were just holding hands the whole way. Well, it just seems that they're not holding hands anymore. And you see Bill hanging on, clinging to Hillary, and actually doing things that are way out of character. Let me just give you an example. When he blew up at the superdelegates in California a couple weeks ago, see, he could have done things differently if he were still associated with the big guys. The big guys could have made a call, it would have been a backroom deal, and nobody would have heard about it. But here Billy is out there, has to get steamed up in public and make a big public disgrace of himself, trying to, you know, con these superdelegates into being on Hillary's side. But the point is that it doesn't seem that Bill is in good standings with the Bush, the elder Bush crowd anymore, which they were quite a bit a number of years ago. So that's just an interesting observation, and someone may want to carry that a little farther out there, but there's an old expression that we used to use back in the California days, look with the venture capital groups and stuff like that. The old expression was, you don't shake hands with the Bushes, because 99% of the people that do end up in, let's say, not too good a condition, because they tend to use people and then throw them out to dry. And you have to understand the history of the Bushes and the Clintons all the way back to Arkansas in the old CIA days, and I'm not going to go into that on this show. If you want a good description of that, there's a book called Compromised, Bush, Clinton, and the CIA. Get that book and read it. It's a real eye-opener for a lot of people. But, they go way back, but there seems to be a rift between the Clintons and the Bushes. And, of course, old man Bush is endorsing McCain or McClone, whatever you want to call him. So there does seem to be a rift there, and that's very interesting politically, because remember that Forbes magazine, not more than a year or so ago, announced that Bill Clinton was the most powerful man in the world. This was just a couple of years ago, well into the George W. Bush presidency. And, of course, Bill Clinton was having meetings at the UN. He was going around with his international UN program to bring science together. He had everything going under the sun. And now, all of a sudden, Billy doesn't seem to have all of his irons in the fire that he used to have. And he seems to be on the skids with the Bushes. So just an interesting observation. And so when you get up to those high levels, the pecking order gets pretty strange, let's put it that way. So at any rate, now I want to talk about the Berkey offer. I failed to get that posting up last week, right after the show. But for foreign orders, there is now a special tab, order button, on my secure web ordering page. And also, these can be ordered by mail. So I'll give out that mail order desk quick here, and the web URL. I'll give that out in a second. But trying to help people in foreign countries get a Berkey, I've reduced the shipping costs. Now, I cannot change the price of the unit itself. Those are set by the manufacturer, so I cannot change that. But to help people in foreign countries get a Berkey water system, and so they will know a set price for shipping. And what I've done is made arrangements for a set price for shipping, which is very minimal. So for people in Canada, the total is $410. That's $399 for the Berkey water filter and a pair of PF2 filters. Those are the fluoride arsenic add-on filters, plus $11 for shipping. And so I can set that constant cost for shipping to Canada. It's $31 for shipping to all other countries. So for Canada, the total is $410 for a complete Berkey water system with the two extra black Berkey filters and the two fluoride arsenic filters. That's $410 to Canada and $430 to all other countries. So that's going to save you around $30 to $40 in shipping due to some special arrangements that I've made. So at any rate, what you get in that is the Berkey water filter, gravity feed water filter. You will get two black Berkey filter elements and two spare black Berkey water filter elements for a total of four black Berkey water filter elements, and two fluoride arsenic filters. Those are the add-on filters that takes out arsenic from well water and city water, and also the fluoride. So in this is complete package, as I said, would normally cost $399 in the U.S. You get free shipping, but to Canada, it's usually been quite a bit of, and to foreign countries, the shipping has been fairly expensive. So I can now set to Canada $11 for shipping, to foreign countries $31 for shipping. So it's $410 to Canada, $430 to all other countries. And the mail order address, JMCC, P.O. Box 58, Navarre, N-A-V-A-R-R-E, Minnesota, 55392, USA, or go to the webpage, JMCC, S is in Sam, C is in Charlie, I is in Indigo.com. That's seven letters, JMCCSCI.com. I'll give that again later in the show. And for, of course, anybody in the 50 states, shipping is free for the Berkey water systems. Now, some fun economic facts. Just a few minutes of this before I go into the main science topic of the chemistry of comet tails. So a few fun economic facts, since this is kind of an economic week. First of all, globalization, something, a term you hear a lot about now, pros and cons. This started really in 1913 when the European banks came in, created the Federal Reserve, and Woodrow Wilson, I believe it was, famous for his turning over the congressional banking system to the foreign bankers. And basically destroying our monetary value that was congressionally designated and creating the Federal Reserve notes, which, of course, is paper money. Now, it was not much longer that they destroyed the gold standard, but that's another entire issue. But the point is that shortly after 1913 came the First World War. Now, if you examine wars prior to that, the prior wars were basically empire building, conquest by a single country, or control of the seas by a particular country, control of particular geographic or economic areas by particular countries or country alliances. But World War I was the first war managed by the European bankers, where there was ethnic readjustment, I would call it. That's the term I would use. Ethnic readjustment of the world. And so the idea was to destroy Germany because it was basically a nation that had formed from the Israelite that moved out of Egypt. Now, the movement of populations after the great disaster, after the Israelites had moved out of Egypt, after the Babylonian and Assyrian captivities, many of those groups moved up into what are now called Ireland, Northern England, Scandinavia. I was talking about the Vikings last week. Nobody ever talks about where these groups came from or the populations that were up in the Germanic populations. Where did those people come from? And it really doesn't fit into the story that about 7,000 years ago, man left Mesopotamia and eventually came across the Bering Strait to populate the Western civilization, the Western Hemisphere civilizations. None of that makes any sense at all. Because what really happened is after the great disaster, the world was actually fully populated at one time before. That's when Atlantis was here. There was one ocean called the Ocean of the Atlanteans. Remember that the Pacific Ocean was not named until Balboa got there in the Middle Ages, so to speak. It was lost, the knowledge of that ocean was lost prior to those Magellan and Balboa getting around the southern tip of South America. And remember that the South America and Central America were highly populated at that time. In fact, that's why they call it Tierra del Fuego, the southern tip of South America, because as they came through, as Magellan came through there, there were so many fires up in the mountains that it lit up like a city. So they called it Tierra del Fuego. That was the source of that name. And they landed and the natives came out and there were actually giants living there at the time. There was a giant, they brought out a giant femur from a human and supposedly there was a giant that actually got onto one of the last giants of South America, got onto Magellan's ship and died on the way back. He didn't make it all the way back to around the world, so to speak. But at any rate, the world was populated at one time. Then the great disaster hit and all of these populations were segmented. And the Tibetan, the Chinese, and the populations in India fared much better, and that's why they have the enormous populations that we see there today. The Western Hemisphere is not far behind. We're reaching that cusp, especially in the United States, where we're hitting that 400 million mark very soon, and that will balloon very rapidly into our first billion. That's going to happen probably within the next 10 years, if there isn't another major catastrophe somewhere in the middle. But back to the war, First World War. The First World War was a war of ethnic readjustment that was controlled by the world bankers, where all countries were brought into this fray. And then, of course, World War II was the same thing, always quoted during the time as the war to end all wars. Another war of ethnic readjustment, once again to try and cripple the Germanic crowds that were the remnants. They started out as the remnants of the Israelite populations that left back in Egypt and in Babylon, back in what we now kind of call prehistory. But at any rate, so the globalization of the world and the use of money, taxation, and phony wars to the phony reasons for wars has been going on since around 1913. So that's one of the first kind of fun economic facts that I wanted to put out. Now, let's look at 1950, the end of the war to end all wars. World War II was over. The American population was trying to get back. And in 1950, there was a certain amount of money in circulation. Now, let's look at what happened in the last month with the Federal Reserve creating money out of thin air to bail out the likes of Bear Stearns, many banks, and the laundry list of banks now that are claiming financial disaster is running into the dozens, if not hundreds. They're running to the Fed saying, give us money too. Gee, that's swell if you're a business, you're a private bank, and all of a sudden somebody's giving out money. I guess you want to get in line for it. But the point is that the Federal Reserve in the last month has created more money out of thin air than existed, than the total amount of money in existence in the year 1950. So that's a fun economic fact to think about. So where did all the money come from that is now in circulation between 1950 and now today, 2008? Well, the answer is that it was created out of thin air. And this has been the scam. So when people start talking about, the economy, these are the fun facts that they always ignore, they always skim over or bypass. These are the rudimentary concepts of economy, and I find that the more educated people are, the less they know about these facts. I've talked to this past week a person with a master's degree in finance and has no clue where money comes from, or what the political situation is in the world. Still thinks that that person happens to be a Republican, thinks that the Democrats are the cause of all problems, and not understanding that welfare works two ways. There's welfare for the rich, and there's welfare for the poor. And, of course, there's another myth that, of course, this is tax week. One of the biggest myths is that taxes pay for something like the social services, things like that. The total amount of taxes collected does not even begin to put a dent in the interest on the national debt, let alone provide any kind of services or for the war or whatever. All of that just keeps going on this credit card, on the national credit card. Those are just a few fun facts about economics. And just one last kind of fun fact, that the federal government of the U.S. is literally the biggest business in the world. It has more employees, it has a bigger budget than any other business in the world. So isn't that interesting? Now, that means that there's a lot of people who make their living off of this system. So they don't want to see it go away. The people who are being strangled to support this. And it's just like back in the old days of what you see it in the movies where the sheriff or the king's henchmen go out and collect pigs and chickens and eggs, and that's the food that the people are eating. Well, those are the taxes they're collecting. Well, it's pretty much the same right now. And this goes to feed this enormous business engine that we call the federal government. So just imagine the people who pay in that work in that system versus the money they get back. It's a very good investment for them because that's where their source of income comes from. So that's a very interesting concept that the United States federal government is the biggest business not only in the United States but in the world. Just another little fun fact, economic fact. On to the science topic of the night, chemistry of comet tails. Now, if you look at all of the organic compounds that make up your body, one has to wonder where all of this material came from. And, of course, the process of a baby being conceived or a little animal or a plant or whatever. Of course, every plant, every animal, it's very interesting. Say you could plant a seed of one plant right next to the other one, and the chemical properties that will develop in one plant are totally different than the plant that grows up right next to it, even though they're growing in the same ground. So there's a very interesting, it's just like frogs in the jungle of South America. They're still finding new species of frogs that they hope will develop new pharmaceutical chemicals that could be used for treating disease, things like that. So every human, every animal, every plant species seems to have quite a bit of a different chemical makeup, but based on the same rudimentary building blocks. Now, I said at the beginning of the show that comet tails show a very highly developed set of chemicals, and you can start with water, carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide, a wide range of hydrocarbons all the way down from the very smallest ones to the very large complex chains that we find in oil, like crude oil. They have the nitrogen-hydrogen compounds. You have everything from the simplest forms of ammonia up to very complex, once again, nitrogen-hydrogen compounds. How do these form in space? And now I want to just go back briefly to the so-called dirty snowball comet model, which is, of course, totally incorrect, has not a grain of truth in it, but is being promoted by the standard astronomical community. They claim, and of course this was a spin-off of my work, which I said originally that life has to form in the tail of comets. There has to be a certain amount of development of organic compounds in comet tails. But of course I was talking about in the electric environment of the plasma discharge comet tail. And of course they had to make their twist on it, so they turned it into comets must have organic chemicals, and they were actually able to see with infrared signatures some of these complex chemicals. So they had to make up a reason for it, and so they said, well, they were assimilated into this dirty snowball back at the beginning of time when the solar system was formed. But there's a little problem there in that they didn't say where the organic chemicals originally formed. Well, they couldn't say because it doesn't fit into any of their models. And so out of sight, out of mind, and of course, as I said, you can't ask NASA a question because there's no format. There's no formal way to ask a question. Their articles that are published are not put through any sort of peer review, so there's no way to interject a question, an intelligent question like, well, you say that these chemicals were incorporated into the ice ball, but where were they formed in the first place? No answer there. So at any rate, there is an answer, and that answer is that the dirty snowball comet model is simply incorrect. The observation of complex organic chemicals in a comet tail, now another is due to the electrical conditions in the tail of a comet. Now, I want to use a very specific example. When Schumacher-Levy 9 was a comet that broke into 21 pieces and eventually came in and hit the backside of Jupiter a number of years ago, back in the 90s. And it was a very beautiful array, and they had a lot of pictures that were taken of this as the 21 pieces came into the realm of Jupiter. As they were outside of the realm of Jupiter, there were 21 perfectly formed mini water comets, the tail material being primarily water. As they entered the realm of Jupiter, gee, all of a sudden all that water went away and the tails became, all 21 of them, became primarily composed of sulfur dioxide, which is a component, it's a fairly rudimentary chemical compound, sulfur dioxide, a sulfur with two oxygen on it, and that's a kind of an orangish-reddish color, and the tails of all 21 comet pieces became sulfur dioxide. That's because the comet draws its tail material from the local environment. And so you have in the area of Jupiter, you have oxygen, you have sulfur, but how does the sulfur dioxide form? And so there, one could refer to chemical tables. These are well known, well published. The energy of formation of molecules, and these are very well known. How much energy does it take to add that one particular atom or string of atoms or complex organic molecule and join these together to form a larger one? Now, the question is, how do these chemicals form? Well, in a laboratory, you could form them using an electric discharge and gases in a chamber. That would be one way to do it, and this has been done very successfully. So all of these properties of these chemicals are well known. When we reverse those processes, for example, when you take oil, crude oil, which came from space as Earth at one time went through the tail of a comet, all of these complex hydrocarbons were in the tail of the comet built up. These then rained in on Earth, and people now dig them up out of the ground or bring them up through a tube, and these have to be refined and broken down into the various grades of jet fuel, everything down to gasoline and the finer distillates that are used in everything to make plastic, everything we use coming from oil. And, of course, the idea that these are fossil fuels is absolutely incorrect, because the so-called fossil fuels are found all over the earth in places where there were no fern forests growing. But back to the concept of how these form in outer space. You have nitrogen, hydrogen, carbon, oxygen. You have all the rudimentary building blocks out there in a gaseous form. And you can actually see these out in the solar system. It's well known that they're out there. But how do they come together and form into more complex molecules? Well, that's where the comet comes in. The comet discharge of the solar capacitor creates a negatively charged nucleus, and all of the details of this are in my books, the Planet X Comets and Earth Changes book, and the rest of the series of books describe how this happens. But the electric field then draws in the positive ions. And so they come in on electric fields, and as they get closer to the nucleus, they encounter each other. The atoms collide. They have enough energy to come together. Let's take an example of Hale-Bopp, that massive comet, actually about a medium-sized comet, that was in the solar system for about 6 years, back in the mid to late 90s, all the way into the year 2000, was still visible with good equipment. And at times there were 7 to 10, I think there was one picture we counted, 17 individual water tails, like big snakes, tentacles that would flip around out in outer space, and these were visible. So what happens is as the currents, the electric currents in the comet tail are drawn into the nucleus, the atoms come closer together, they become more energetic, they have energy that's sufficient that when they hit they can combine and form the more complex molecules. And you also have the extended electric fields. My Calculate Primes book goes into a small discussion on how snowflakes form. And, of course, snowflakes have been made in a laboratory, but guess what? You need an electric field. So where is the electric field that exists in the upper regions of the atmosphere where snowflakes are forming? Well, that's part of the same vertical electric field that powers hurricanes and is a result of the overall solar electric field created by the sun, the same electric field that comets discharge and which is responsible for the formation of these very complex molecules in the tails of comets. Now, just a little bit on the science of infrared spectroscopy. That's a area of study where you take a signature, you take a chemical light signature in the infrared that's light that's little less energetic than the visible light that we see. But remember that fish and cats and dogs can all see in the infrared. Bats, for example, or the little blind mice with the big red eyes can see in the infrared. That's just a less energetic light, and we're not privy to that with our eyes. Our eyes are primarily able to see visible light. But there is equipment that can scan through the spectrum of a cloud of gas that's illuminating, that's giving off heat light, suppose is another term for it, which is infrared light. And you can look at the spectrum, the various lines of energy that come off of the light from the comet tail or from another source, and you can tell the chemicals that are in that cloud. Now, I want to be a little more specific. When you do this, you rarely can see the big complex molecules. You typically can only detect the very rudimentary molecules. So let's take, for example, a nitrogen-hydrogen compound built up to a very complex ammonia, or they call them basically ammonia-related molecules, but some have many more hydrogens and nitrogen atoms in them than others. So how do these build up? Well, and how do you detect them? Well, the reality is that with infrared spectroscopy, you cannot detect or differentiate, I should say, the great big molecules. So they should be there, or they could be there, but all you're seeing are the more rudimentary forms of the molecule. You're just seeing little pieces of that bigger molecule. So scientists are pretty much unaware of the size and scope of and complexity of organic molecule development in comet tails. And as I said at the beginning of the show, I've said this many times, that the comet tails also develop viruses. And so these new strains of virus that come around every time Venus comes around, for example, is an example of viruses forming. And these are extremely complex organic systems forming in outer space. And that's, by the way, is why it's a very bad idea for us to bring any spacecraft back into the Earth environment unprotected, as NASA has been doing very flagrantly, violating any common sense at all, bringing spacecraft back into the atmosphere that could be contaminated with outer space viruses. Remember the ones that crashed into the desert and basically broke open, and then you see a picture of guys out there in bib overalls picking this crashed vehicle up that came in from outer space and being exposed potentially to viruses. Back to the topic of chemistry of comet tails. So the idea is that the comet tails form in these tremendously complex molecules. Earth itself, as it developed into a planet, was a comet. So a lot of these chemicals are already locked in the mantle and crust of the Earth and deep inside. And through the millennia, as we pass through comet tails, especially the big ones like we did a number of thousands of years ago, where it is historically documented, the rain of naphtha, the chunks of matter coming in, the burning naphtha, it came into the atmosphere burning, ignited by electrical discharges and lightning bolts, and of course the Great Flood, tremendous amount of water. The same situation. Water needs a little bit of energy to form, and once it starts forming, of course, they use that for rocket fuel. It's one of the most energetic chemical recombinations known, hydrogen and oxygen forming to make water. And, of course, water being one of the primary components of comet tails. So no small wonder that Earth is a water planet. Someday Venus will also be a water planet, but not in any of our lifetimes. In the far distant future, many of those chemicals still being locked in, for example, sulfuric acid in the atmosphere of Venus. So basically, the chemicals, the complex compounds that we see on planet Earth, many of them came from outer space. The sodium that came from outer space to form the salt in our oceans, etc. So the complex chemistry of Earth depends on our having been in the tails of comets many times to get a wide cross-section of these organic compounds. So I hope that gives you a good feeling for what comets are really doing out there. They're building up. Remember that not all comets become planets. There's a whole wide range. There are very small comets that really don't have enough gravitational attraction to hold the matter they are drawing in, so the matter just eventually blows back out in the solar wind. But the big comets, the ones that can form planets, the rare ones, the ones we don't see very often, thank goodness, are the ones that develop tremendously complex atmospheres, oceans, etc. And of course, we see this on Titan. We see this on the other moons around the solar system. Very complex and very diverse, complex organic molecular systems on these planets. And that's, of course, why NASA is so befuddled. Every time they go to a new moon, it's supposed to be just an inert, dry rock, and they're not. So where does all of this organic activity come from? Well, that all of these moons and planets, except for Jupiter, all of them formed as a giant comet at one time in the solar system history. So that's why you see the tremendous variation. Also, the Kuiper objects, the thousands of objects they are discovering out beyond the orbit of Pluto, which are planetary-sized round objects. Where did these form? Well, the same situation. They all formed slowly over time. Most of those out there formed rather slowly. But the same situation where they developed and brought in the material as comets, discharging the solar capacitor. So I want to spend the last minute once again reviewing this offer for the Berkey water filters. Once again, it's been a problem for foreigners to try and order these because of the tremendously high cost of shipping. So what I've done is I made arrangements for a limited time only to ship the Berkey water filter and the PF2 filters. This is a package, and it really has to be ordered like this. So its normal price is $399. That price is set by the manufacturer. So you get the Berkey water filter plus four black Berkey water filter elements, two you use, two you keep as spares, plus the PF2, two of the PF2 filters, which are the fluoride arsenic filters, and then $11 for shipping to Canada, $31 shipping to all other countries, so the total is $410 to Canada, $430 to other countries. The address, JMCC, P.O. Box 58, Navarre, N-A-V-A-R-R-E, Minnesota 55392, or go to the webpage jmccsci.com. That's JM2Cs. S as in Sam, C as in Charlie, I as in Indigo.com, and go to the secure web ordering page for the link for that special. And of course, the 50 states shipping is free. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.